Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone, and that's my short title. I'm going to pick up on a number of issues that have already come up at the conference this afternoon as well, but also in the opening session yesterday, particularly the issue around the fact that we actually have quite a bit of knowledge about public health and about interventions and about what works, and that the challenge facing many of us, both as academics and as policymakers and practitioners, is how we act on that evidence. And the idea of action was central to Michael Marmot's talk yesterday. The second theme was the issue about how we are accumulating more and more knowledge. It came up in the opening session, it came up in the evening entertainment last night, that in a sense, we're very good at stockpiling the knowledge. What we're less good at doing is applying that knowledge. And as an academic, I can see it from both sides. As an academic, getting funding to stockpile the knowledge is what we do. But it isn't enough. And wearing my other hat as chair of the UK Public Health Association, I can see it from the practice policy side in terms of us allowing much of that evidence to wash over policymakers and practitioners in a way that doesn't engage or connect with them. So the relationship between research, evidence, and policy and practice is far from optimal. And I think we desperately need to understand, if we're going to maximise the opportunities that Fiona talked about and Jeff talked about, if we're going to seize that opportunity and that window that presents itself, as Michael Marmot said yesterday, then we have to understand why we have this less than optimal relationship between evidence and policy and practice. And by the way, those of you who happen to find yourselves in England next March in Brighton are very welcome to come to our UK PHA annual conference on health inequalities, where we're going to be looking at the evidence base in terms of why we know a lot about inequality but aren't using that evidence. The weather will not be as it is here, so please do not bring your swimming costume. It'll be bracing. Right. Yeah, none to disclose. Fine. Right, the next... The general journey is towards trying to rationalise policy, trying to strengthen the evidence base, trying to get away from opinion-based policy, which arguably we've had in the past, although I would say we still have much of that around, towards evidence-based policy. That's the general direction of travel. Let's be more rational, let's be more systematic, let's be more knowledgeable in what we do, not driven by ideology or emotion or whatever. And in their report, the commission that Michael Marmot chaired make this point that we need research to understand what we're doing, but we need that evidence in practical, accessible ways. And I think that's one of the problems that we confront in the evidence. And again, coming at this from an academic perspective, quite often researchers are the last people to put evidence across in practical, accessible ways. Now, maybe that means someone else has to do that, but it may well be that academics themselves have to take much more responsibility for what they are telling policymakers in terms of how they communicate those messages, and I'll come back to that. So we need new understanding, but we'll only get that understanding if we present that evidence in practical, accessible ways. In an earlier piece that Michael Marmot wrote, an editorial in the British Medical Journal in 2004, talking about issues around alcohol policy, he made the point that science and policy and practice do not always sit easily together, and that science has to engage people who already have positions and already have views which they will be very anxious to ensure dominate, and if not carry the day in terms of a particular policy or intervention. And just to continue that, he made the point that far from people taking action because the evidence has influenced them, they will select the evidence to support and back up what they already have as a starting position in respect to the policy. And again, I think we have to understand that. We don't necessarily have to agree with it. We have to understand that that is the dynamic that quite often drives policy making. So, evidence. What evidence? Well, often, as I've said, the evidence exists. We're awash with it. And the fact is we're not using it, or we're ignoring it, or it's certainly not used consistently or continuously or proportionately or even at all in some cases. And let me give two very brief examples. Let me take the example of health system readers' organisation. we're all at it. We're a market leader in my country, but all countries are at it to some degree in terms of being fixated and preoccupied with reorganizing their health systems. Some might need reorganization, I'm not denying that, but others like ours that have been at it since 1974, we're on the 14th major reorganization of our healthcare system, it becomes a bit of a distraction. Or we breed change junkies who live to change the system rather than deliver better outcomes for health. However, let me get these points up. We know from the evidence, there's an extensive evidence internationally now from Australia, from Europe, from the UK, that fiddling around with structures is futile. They do not lead to improved efficiency or to better outcomes. That if anything, the challenge is a cultural one, not a structural one, and yet we spend all our energy on the structure, not on the cultural change that might be more productive. And that part of this issue is a temporal one. Long-term goals always run counter to political short-termism. Politicians like to seem to be doing things, and it's easier to change the structure that's visible than to deal with culture that might be less visible. So inconvenient evidence, such as that which exists to say that what politicians spend the time doing is not very productive, is often ignored or marginalized or just rejected in favor of what might be termed more symbolic policymaking. Let me give another example, the example of public health. And we've touched on this already. Government's fearful of being labeled the nanny state that Jeff mentioned in his talk. They didn't used to fear that label so much. Nannies used to be in. But nannies are out of fashion now, and governments reflect that. Government role is therefore to be an enabler, a facilitator, rather than a steward. Fiona mentioned the word steward, and I think stewardship is very important. And we've seen examples of it in terms of the smoking ban in public places in the UK and other countries in Europe. But on the whole, governments are ambivalent about occupying that role. They'd rather be the enabler, the facilitator. They'd rather provide people with information, advice, leaflets, education. Let them make the choice. They're responsible for their decisions. Let's make them more informed decisions. But at the end of the day, it's individuals that make those decisions, and government's role is restricted to providing them with the best evidence available to make those decisions optimally. And therefore, the focus tends to be on individual risk behaviours and less on the social determinants of health and the need for government action. All the things that Michael Mark talked about yesterday, governments are reluctant to engage with. Again, wasn't always the case, but latterly is very much in evidence that when it comes to the social structural determinants of health, governments back off. And the reasons for that we need to understand. And let me quote John Maynard Keynes. Keynes is making a bit of a comeback in the light of the economic downturn. but I think this is one of his more memorable quotes, which I think we need to revisit and reinstate. Because one of the paradoxes is that governments are one of our major funders of healthcare research. In all our various countries, a lot of the research for health and health policy comes from government, either directly or through various research councils that they fund. And yet, the more evidence there is, the less government seems to want to engage with much of that evidence. It seems to be unable to access or use that evidence. It seems almost dismissive of much of that evidence. It doesn't seem to know why it's funding it in the first place, and yet it is a major funder of healthcare research. So I find that a huge paradox that we might want to have some discussion about. Let me run through then some policy-making models, because these models, I think, help us understand why we have the problems we do in terms of that problematic interface between evidence and practice. I'll just put them up quickly. There are seven of them, I think, if I can count. And these come from an article in PLOS Medicine 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And I'll just run through them very quickly, a sentence on each, because I think together there are elements of all of these in evidence in our different countries in respect of delivering research that tries to, in one way or another, engage with policy. So all of these have some value, but I would argue one or two are more important than others. And the first one is the one that we tend to allow us to delude ourselves into thinking that research leads to better policy. There's a kind of rational linear model underpinning this notion of the knowledge-driven model of evidence, which is that once we have the knowledge, then we apply it. It tells us what to do. And therefore, there's a direct connection between the knowledge base and the policy. The problem-solving model is an instrumental view whereby research provides evidence to solve policy problems. And I would argue that's quite a common model. Governments like that in the sense that they like to think they've identified a problem and are getting hold of research that they may fund to tackle that problem, come up with a solution. On the other hand, when that evidence is threatening or contesting what governments are doing by way of the policy, then they cease to like that model. They tend to find that uncomfortable to live with. Then we have the interactive model, and arguably this is the one I think we need to be striving for. This is acknowledging what we've already said this afternoon, that policy is complex, and we need to have research and methods of research that engage with that complexity in terms of finding some solutions. And that's talking about the search for knowledge, embracing a whole range of different kinds of sources and influences, including politics, as part of the construction of how the evidence base might shift policy. So as part of that dialogue that Jeff was talking about, we need to engage with stakeholders in the academic community that also understand the politics and the complexity of policy making. So the interactive model, I would argue, is the one we need to strive for, but it's the one that tends to get a bad press at the moment. The political model is simply saying research is not welcome unless it serves political gain. It has to support what policymakers are already wanting to do or think they're doing. And often we have to accept that that isn't always the case. I know we've done research, many of you may have been involved in research, where you get the call from the Department of Health or the government saying, what can you tell us about this policy that's going to be good news? The minister needs to make a speech and he wants good news. And we say, well, we haven't got good news, we've got different kinds of news, some's good, some's less good, some's pretty awful. No, no, we just want the good news. Give us the story that we can use for the minister's speech to justify this policy. So that's the political model of research, and I'm sure we've all had examples of being involved in that. And then we have the enlightenment model, which is that over time, gradually, research begins to shape the environment or shape the policy view of the world in terms of how people think about issues. And that has some validity and some resonance, but obviously it's over time. And as we know, policy moves very quickly and is very dynamic, and therefore research often is unable to keep up to speed in terms of the policy process, which in recent years has become much more of a driver of rapid change. And then finally, we have the tactical model, which is that evidence is often used to defer decision-making, defer a policy, allow government not to commit itself one way or the other. And I suspect that's why governments find research most useful, when they can use it to justify not doing anything at all, but to indulge in what some civil servant called masterly inactivity. Where you can say, we can't act yet because the evidence is incomplete. We don't know enough. We don't have the perfect knowledge base to enable us to move one way or the other. It's not unequivocal, the evidence. Well, of course, the evidence is very rarely unequivocal and very rarely will tell you the right answer. But when governments want to believe that there is a right answer, they can use the absence of that certainty to defer taking action. So I think those models are quite useful in terms of helping us understand this problem of researchers and policymakers in terms of establishing some sort of mutually beneficial relationship. And I'm suggesting that we need to think about a compact. Now, this term compact comes from work that's been done in medicine between clinicians and managers, both in the US and the UK and other countries. In recent years, doctors have become increasingly unhappy because they've become much more managed as a group. And a lot of work's been done both in your country and in the UK and elsewhere in terms of how we can get a different relationship between managers and clinicians. And this is called a compact, rethinking the relationship between those groups. And I'm suggesting we need something similar in regard to policymaking and the research community. That we should acknowledge that research shouldn't simply be rejected because it's perceived as possibly threatening or confrontational or contesting what politicians like to do. And that research will not necessarily provide quick solutions or necessarily appealing solutions. Secondly, that as far as possible, we should test policies against available evidence as the norm. Now, we try to do that in terms of health impact assessment, equity audits, and else other tools and techniques in public health. We do try and do that, but arguably not systematically enough and not convincingly enough. And thirdly, we should try, and I think this is a call on researchers themselves, research needs to be available when needed. It needs to offer practical solutions as far as possible. It needs to be communicated in ways which fit the policy direction. Now, we know all this, but I would argue that researchers and policymakers occupy parallel universes for much of the time, and that academics are being judged on quite different criteria from any of these. And while their careers might benefit from that, I don't think they can then expect what they're producing in terms of knowledge about what works and doesn't work then necessarily connects with the policy process. And that requires a different relationship and a different way of working and a different way of assessing performance, if you like, or impact. So part of this is the research community itself acknowledging the need to change and accepting the poor fit between policy research and the needs of policymakers has to rely on a number of factors. And I think one of them is simply less descriptive research. We have a huge wealth of descriptive research. We endlessly reanalyze the problem. We know health is bad. We know inequalities are widening in many of our societies. We know what the problem is. The problem isn't lack of description or lack of descriptive research. So I would argue, why do we continue to fund that kind of research? Why don't we fund research that arguably is where we need the added mileage? More real-life applied research. That's not to say blue skies research isn't important, but arguably we need better applied research, how we engage with policymakers in terms of the evidence around a particular intervention and its evaluation. More engagement with the practice community, getting dirty, getting down there, getting dirty with practitioners. More research on the socio-economic and environmental interventions. Again, the Commission's report says we know a lot, and we do, but arguably that's where we know maybe slightly less than we should do in terms of those drivers. I mean, as we saw from the Foresight report on obesity, we know that many of the drivers of obesity in terms of the obesogenic environment are related to those sorts of concerns. So we do have some evidence, but arguably that's where we should be focusing our attention, not on the descriptive research. And finally, less research on behavioural individual risk factor modification. We know that that kind of research isn't terribly productive, but we continue to do it and we continue to fund it. And finally, we need to encourage researchers to engage with policy and practice in a way that, for the most part, most people don't, for one reason or another. There isn't time to go into that, but there is still, as I say, that problematic interface between those groups. So this isn't to say that we don't need research and evidence. We clearly do. We don't need to assume that evidence will automatically lead to better policy. Public health is an art and a science, as we said in terms of its definition. But it doesn't have to be an act of faith, which it arguably often is, unless we engage to some extent with the evidence base. So, finally, what's needed to act on global health? Well, beyond business as usual, which is increasingly unfeasible, we've heard that we face momentous challenges and that to continue in the way we are is not an option. So failing to engage optimally with research and policy and practice is clearly something which has to be attended to, that we need to heed the evidence which exists. We need to make use of the knowledge that we already have and have acquired. Thirdly, we know much about the social determinants of health. We do not yet know enough. So arguably, that's where there's the knowledge gap. But we have enough to begin to make the advances that Michael Marmot talked about yesterday. Political will is needed to implement difficult but feasible challenges. Again, that theme runs through the Commission's report. It's not a new notion, but at the end of the day, that is often what is hardest of all to achieve. But it's something that researchers and academics can't ignore. And to that extent, we have to become advocates for what we believe is important. If we produced a knowledge base that we think is professionally robust and something that we feel can stand up in terms of influencing policy, then we need to go that next step, I think, and become advocates for that evidence base and ensure that policymakers, in a sense, are put on the line about why it is they are not using or referring or accessing that evidence. It's not enough for us to deliver it and stand back. We have to engage in an active dialogue at that point. All those issues are made in the Commission's report. And that's gratifying because, in a sense, what they're saying is we don't need more evidence. It's always nice to have evidence. But if we were really stuck and had to put the money somewhere else, then the money should go on how we get that action. And in a sense, what an American political scientist, Aaron Wildavsky, said many years ago before he died, speaking truth to power. If academics believe what they are doing is important, then it's their job, it's for them to ensure that speaking truth to power is put on the agenda. And it's not enough just to publish the erudite article in Public Health or anywhere else, important though that is. They've got to engage with policymakers on their terms to move the agenda forward. Thanks very much.
Our speakers have provided a good deal of information, but they've done it in such an efficient manner that we do have time for questions. I think they would appreciate it if you could stand so we could hear from the back of the room, and please feel free. Yeah. Comments?
Cackles.
Cackles, no.
As well, and I came in the United States, and it's nice to visit a location from Europe here. My question is, growing up in Europe and South Europe, I know the cultures are different from the Northern European countries, and I think the second speaker talks about how we need to do, in order to promote public health, to have intergovernmental collaboration. And know that the culture of the people living is also reflected in the government. How are you going to try to foster that collaboration between, you know, the different governments, whether the different cultures based on geography or other differences?
Let me see if I have this. Given the different cultures of government and the need for intergovernmental cooperation, how are we going to deal with those cultural differences? Is that? Which
I was just curious, you know, because I think it's a huge task. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. The answer is that there are very different cultures. And the first thing, I think, that when I was lucky enough to chair the Tallinn Charter process, so I was the lucky person who had to bring together 53 including my own governments, to actually think about this. First thing is to acknowledge that the differences are there. It's not about trying to homogenize everybody and say we're all the same, because that just isn't true and it doesn't help. I think the thing is to go back to what is our common purpose. What are the things that we're all facing in terms of problems? So across Europe, even in, we mirror the world in the sense that we've got low, middle and high income countries. But they're all facing issues with cost containment of healthcare systems. They're all facing problems with rising rates of chronic disease, for example. So that gives you a starting point. All their populations, by and large, think that they need to do better on health and healthcare systems. And that gives us a common point. The fact that some governments may have very different ways, not only in terms of their democratic structures, for doing that, you know, is challenging. But actually what I found was that once government representatives and governments could see how they fitted into these values and the actions and the description of the system, and they could think, okay, when I go back to my country, this is how I'm going to use those values, this is how I'm going to use these principles, and I will do it in my way, in my culture, in my politics, bearing in mind my economic situation and the community participation I've got, then actually you've got something that was pretty powerful. And if they felt that organisations that they need to relate to, like the European Commission or the World Bank, actually had gone through the same process with them, then maybe, and it remains to be seen all the things that will happen, maybe that means that the system will begin to align and help me as a government to do this. And I think one of the things that really struck me and was a fantastic part of being part of that process was just how much we learned from each other. Having the debates, we spent, you know, 2 or 3 hours discussing what equity meant for us as countries. And people were worried that it was just a blank check to meet every single healthcare need that their citizens could ever come up with. Well, that's certainly not how we look at it in the UK. So it was about having just, you know, discussion about, well, how do you interpret this, given where we start from? And it really meant, I think, that there was a hunger, if you like, at the end of it, to want to work together in the future, but also to be open and transparent about the problems that we face. Even if we, you know, even if it's difficult sometimes to do that in public, in the view of the press, you can do it with other officials to really try to understand and ground it in the practical things that you need to challenge. So that was some of it. But I think the fact that we have fantastically diverse cultures across Europe is one of our great strengths, just as it is for you in the United States. And I think that we need to hang on to that and not try to homogenize it.
Jennifer, David, do you want to add?
No.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Mary Ellis, grew up in New York City, a musician. And I'd actually venture to say your model about the international perspective also applies to communities and to our own government departments. Within the United States, the USDA and the Health and Human Services, they're two totally different cultures. And likewise, if we're having conversations between environment and nutrition, or you're sitting down around anti-hunger and nutrition, often the assumption is it's the same conversation, but it's not. They have different cultures, different terms, same terms meaning different things. And so that model you mentioned, it applies across.
It does.
And I think it needs to be used more consistently
it does.
In the work we do. Food policy councils in this country actually are working to that end. And I think provide a very good model for that kind of conversation.
Thank you.
I mean, one thing I comment on that, and it's something that I've learned, is to guard against what I term health imperialism, which is what I mean, that if you're in a health ministry and you're a public health professional, you think, or certainly I have been prone to think, that my perspective, while I go about doing my business, is the only reason why anybody ever should, of course, which is what every other ministry thinks at the same time. And of course, the real trick, if you can do it, is to say, I'm really interested in your education problems because I think that some of what we're doing could really help you solve them. It's seeing it, it's adapting new languages, as you say, seeing it from other people's perspectives and trying to get it back to that common purpose solution which appeals to everybody.
Yes.
Question on these wholesome papers. I was just thinking, you know, when you mentioned nannyism, on the other hand, the other split images of public health as a policeman. So there's that dual image. And Jeff, you mentioned simplifying things, but like everything in public health, it seemed like the Big Bang Theory, that there's margin. So to all the speakers, maybe a comment about how do you get the public organized behind these policy changes to push politicians with the difficulty of creating evidence-based messages that can be understood by the public. And I'm sure you'll get a Nobel Prize for that.
You go first.
Nobel Prize in the post.
As if. I mean, I think if you've not seen it or read it, Ibsen's play The Enemy of the People makes this point perfectly. It describes a doctor who ends up being ostracized by his whole community because of what he does, and actually all the time he thinks he's on their side. So it's a really big challenge. I think to some extent, and one of the things I guess that is good in this world, is that some of the decision is being taken away from us as public health people or even as governments to worry about. So one of the trends that we found in the UK is that there are internet groups and social networking groups who are actually dealing with some of our problems and then feeding the answers back to us in government. A good example, which some of you may have heard me talk about before, is this organisation called NetMums, which was set up, a group of mothers who were interested in various things, very practical, you know, how do I get what I need for my kid, but also got in some of the policy issues. And when we were debating marketing of food to children, they did a fantastic survey for us looking at that. For themselves, they were very interested in labelling of food. And in fact, they got something like 17,000 families to comment on what they thought the government should do. That's extremely powerful for government. And I think the answer for us in public health is that tension between how we democratize public health. So I think giving people information about what it's like to live in their neighborhood's important. We produce profiles, information of what it was like to live in different areas in the UK. It was covered by the 10 o'clock evening news on the BBC. Within 2 hours, 750,000 people people had downloaded their local profile. And the reason we did that, or at least the reason I was keen on doing it, was to give people the information so they can go to local politicians and say, why does our area have the highest rates of obesity? And there's a great dialogue in the media. I think it's about giving people, getting people to take control of their own health and using the new information technology we have to democratise health in perhaps a way that's not been possible.
I'm glad Fiona spoke first because it gave me a couple of seconds to think about the answer. And I haven't come up with one. I think that actually is the critical issue for public health. And that's why I suppose I was putting Laurie Garrett's thoughts up, because her view was that we just need to rebuild the trust that we once had. Actually, that won't work. We're in a very different society. This is a non-deferential society, even over the last 20 years. And I don't know if it's the same in the US, but I suspect it is. So the issue is really about engaging with people's sense of themselves and their sense of the future. And the trouble is that all of the defences that we have are about defending our way of life. And unfortunately, our way of life is unsustainable. So it's a matter of having a better story of what the future is, backed by research, backed by understanding that things have to change. And it's actually a little bit like in talking to people on the obesity issue. People don't change because of themselves, but they change because of their because of their children and their sense of their children's future. So I think public health people, and I think I've said it before, actually have to be the ones that talk about desirable futures, present evidence about what's wrong now, and also evidence about, you know, alternate paths, and getting those stories out and creating new narratives that change is not necessarily harmful, but you can have qualitative improvement in your lives, and thinking that it is about not, you know, maybe the old expression less is more, but actually there are things which are qualitatively better that we can do without just our existing ways of doing things. So it's actually telling a better story with the evidence we have, and maybe different evidence and more use, better use made of working in different circles. And people have said that, you know, we need to be able to speak the languages of different people. So we need to be able to translate what we say into popular terms and translate other evidence that we're not using into a better way which explains the direction we want to go. Now, I hope that makes some sense, but it's a way of getting out of the complexity issue, of making it better stories, and stories are there to simplify things. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Judith Pelsner. I work at the MacArthur Foundation in Chicago. And I like to think of these issues in terms of specific examples. And one that we're working on, and that your foreign aid agency, DFID, has been a leader on in the world, is maternal mortality reduction. And that's one of the Millennium Development Goals. It's a very complex problem because it relates to poverty and social class as well as health systems. But there are evidence-based specific interventions that we know about, causes of death like postpartum hemorrhage or eclampsia or sepsis. And so I guess I just wondered whether any of you would like to comment on maternal mortality as an example for using the ecological approach or for applying evidence or for making research more useful to policymakers. We've done some research on the political will issues that relate to maternal mortality, both at the global level and in specific countries. I think to me it's a very focused example that might kind of illustrate what you're talking about. If you have any thoughts about that, I'd love to hear them.
I don't know about thoughts, but we face the same problem in my area of England, the North East, which is a very deprived area. The evidence about breastfeeding has been around for 10 years, and yet still there's an issue about how you translate those messages from breastfeeding evidence into poor communities. I think part of the problem is that perhaps the way we've trained our professionals in public health is not necessarily helping to prepare them for a world where they've got to communicate with people in a quite different way. It's touching on some of the things Jeff and Fiona have both been saying. In a sense, our education and our preparation of professionals is behind the evidence base in terms of what we need to do to communicate messages in meaningful ways. The messages need to be
expressed in a positive, health-enhancing way rather than a negative, no, you mustn't do this sort of way. And it seems to me we've not really been very adept at using communication techniques to prepare people in quite simple ways to engage with the kinds of groups that they end up in having to have difficulty with in getting key messages across. The issue isn't the evidence or accessing it for professionals, it's then what you do with it in terms of the people they're working with. And I'm not sure we train or prepare people for that kind of engagement. So a simple thing would be to look at our curricula and see how we can turn that around a bit.
I think you're right. It's a really good example, if you like, of a lightning rod of how we take all that diffuse knowledge and get it into an issue which people understand, care about, and think is important. I think that maybe what it illustrates, and I think in the description that you put forward and in a sense the question you pose, is precisely why it's powerful, is that so many people can see something in it that they can interact with, because people see the very medical thing, somebody dying, you know, as you said, postpartum hemorrhage. But there are also the issues around poverty, empowerment of women, all the kind of things that we don't need to rehearse. So for wherever you come from in a society, maybe you can see that you've got a part not only in the problem but also in its solution. And I think it comes back to that issue about how do we describe things in other people's language, frame it and tell stories in different ways. And then how can we use those stories to illustrate how these problems are connected and how we can work together? And for some people, it doesn't matter if we do. It's about getting action, because that's what really matters. So no, I think it's a perfect example. And I believe that Lancet recently had a series on childhood mortality, or was going to, looking at exactly infant mortality, looking at exactly that issue about what can we learn from it. And so I think you're right. I think that it's exactly the kind of approach we need to be taking.
I just want a quick one. It's actually an historical case. I remember some years ago there was a piece on looking at maternal mortality rates in New York back in the 1920s. And it was quite interestingly inverse phenomenon, because the wealthier the women, the more likely they would have infection rates, and that's because they were attending to hospitals where they had much higher levels of surgery. And the women who'd done best are the ones who actually avoided the hospitals entirely and had maternal services at home with midwives. Now, the point I would draw from that is that actually, not just avoid hospitals if you can do it, but you could say, but actually what you need to do is make the best understanding of health, the one which works in the professional areas and which also works in communities. So an ecological model which look at the knowledge bases of both and actually try for the best results from them. So there's no way out of that, I think, that you need to be able to, you know, not the assumption is that the medical people always know best or that the communities know best or something else, but actually public health have to work within those sets of meanings that you're in, and not avoid those things and say, here's another set of evidence which is outside that again. Yes, you may think you have that, but actually it has to work with the level of meaning that people have and your knowledge in terms of the best results which are likely to work, but actually are always specific to those settings themselves for their real success, if that helps.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Tim Stevens. Jeff, you've been challenging us to think about futures, and yet many of the futurists have been alarmingly wrong at different points in our history. What would be good examples from the past would help us, you know, notwithstanding Malthus and others that didn't quite get the ecological model that they were confronted with, right?
Okay, well, thank goodness that for most of us, not developing countries. I mean, Malthus, actually, I mean, you could say that Malthus had been wrong for 210 years, right? But he's going to be right in the next 50. Actually, Malthus has been wrong right in some places, in a sense. So, you know, don't just write him off. Okay, so we're looking, I mean, futurists are often wrong. And I should hope we are, because if we're using the amount of water use, you know, Being in Australia last year, and I shouldn't be flying to Australia, of course, because I'm damaging the upper ozone layer. And speaking to the public health people involved in the environmental side, they're saying that the population of Australia, in the long term, could have a population of around 6 million, and it's going towards three times that. And that's because it's drawing out of the ground. Its water basis is under the ground, right? In many of those. So it is exporting its own water. When you buy animals raised in Australia or with the large wheat crops. So this isn't just airy-fairy. Herman Kahn used to do this in this country. He's one of the futurists of the 60s, predicting all these things going wrong. Actually, I think it's about detail things, and it's about alternative pathways. It's actually having the scenario settings about the future and actually the one we want best. I mean, in going back to the obesity work in the UK, one of our colleagues projected, put all the numbers together for the future of what our population would be like in around 2050. In terms of current obesity rates. And then you say, what are the things which are naturally going to deflect that path into a different path, i.e. downwards? And because at the moment, the joining up of the dots looks very serious if you project that into the future. Now, that's a story about the future, right, from epidemiology. What is the alternative story you want to have of the change in that? There's a historian called Barrington Moore, one of your countrymen, who talks about suppressed historical alternatives. So he's looking at what could have changed in the past. He's an historian. I think we want to use the reverse principle, is imagine the futures and then provide some of the epidemiological evidence for that likely futures, but also the things that we would have done to change those futures. And it may be, for example, if you're thinking currently about obesity in this country, then it may be something about the price of gasoline going up. Therefore, people aren't doing certain sort of things. So there are lots of the parameters you could take in order to change that what the economists call path dependency. So there are natural ones, and then there are policy ones. And it's interesting to me is that what are the policy measures that would make a difference? And then what are the other measures which we haven't even thought about? You know, I think you have a politician who talks about the futures we haven't even thought, the problems we haven't even thought about. So what I'm saying is that more of that sort of work needs to be done, because they're also quite good stories. It's not just that I'm not saying this is entirely a story. I'm saying if we're looking at the future, we're very good at looking at mining the past in public health, because we can actually talk about successes of the past, but they don't work any longer. That's the problem. And it's the future we should be arguing about. And I think building evidence around alternative scenarios, the likely ones, using epidemiology for suggesting what they are, in some cases putting a cost onto them, human cost, societal cost, cost to the taxpayer, and so on. Because then you're actually dealing with the other worlds and not just our narrow world of public health. Maybe that helps a bit? Okay.
I'm sure that if you have a question that has not been answered, they would be happy to talk to you, but we are at 4 o'clock and we are trying to stay on time. Would you please thank again Drs. Adshead, Hunter, and Rayner? Thank you so much.
That was great. I love your slides. I've forgotten what fabulous slides you bring. Great illustrations.
Yes, I thought it was
very fun. There you go.